Hello, and welcome to Frenzied and Sustained. In this week's podcast for a post-stupid society, our brainy lecture looks at the widdly-jiddly world of superstring theory, and we ask whether a whole generation of physicists have just wasted their lives. We have the real cowboy hat and see how our hat of the week formed a link between Charlie Chaplin, Winston Churchill, Goldfinger's manservant Oddjob, and Alex from A Clockwork Orange. In A Sauce, My Kingdom for a Sauce, I need you to stand by your orchards as we turn our attention and our saucepans to Cider Beurre Blanc. This week's Songs Under the Microscope considers the enduring charm of Polly Put the Kettle On and examine what exactly has kept this infusion-centric ditty in the charts for the last 200 years. That gets us thinking about the whole canon of gruesome English language nursery rhymes. In literally the last section, we investigate how words enter the English language. We also look at body image issues and the glorification of binge eating in the blockbuster book by Eric Carle, The Very Hungry Caterpillar. You are listening to Frenzied and Sustained, and I am Ian Spector, and this is a
brainy lecture.
Superstring theory. For years, scientists have been vexed about having to choose between two beloved children, called little and large by absolutely no one. The large is general relativity with Einstein's field equation, and the little is quantum mechanics with its Schrödinger's equations. Large, general relativity, explains how matter distorts space-time but gets really funky trying to describe what happens in atoms and starts blowing all its diodes down its right-hand side with lots of divisions by zeros and miniature black holes. To be honest, it's not that hot on supermassive scale either. It gets pretty wild with black holes and its predicted singularity. On the other hand, quantum mechanics predicted the Standard Model of particles, and these have been very emphatically confirmed experimentally. The Standard Model of elementary particles is the periodic table of the subatomic particles. Thus, all of nature is described by 12 matter particles called fermions and 5 force-carrying bosons. The fermions are divided amongst the quarks and the leptons. The quarks are found in the nucleus of atoms and are divided into up, down, charm, strange, top and bottom. The world's favourite lepton is the electron, but there is also our short-lived friend the muon, as well as the tau, which is a morbidly obese electron. Each of these three has an associated neutrino called the electron neutrino, muon neutrino, and tau neutrino. Alright, whilst we're at it, let's list the force-carrying bosons: gluon, photon, Z boson, W boson, and of course the Higgs boson. The four forces are mediated by the force-carrying particles jumping between quarks and leptons. And here to explain the Standard Model to us is Hank Green.
A quark is a fundamental constituent of matter. Observed in 1968 through deep elastic scatter, we found that protons aren't as simple as we thought. We thought they were solid particles, but they are not. Protons, in fact, are made up of three separate pieces. It just gets more confusing as our knowledge increases. But that is what a quark is. It's a piece of a proton, and they also make up other things, including the neutron. Oh, up, down, strange, charm, top, bottom. If you don't know what a quark is, it don't matter. You still got them. And with leptons and bosons, unless something's amiss, they make up everything that we can see and that we know exists. Things made up of quarks, including protons and neutrons, are composite particles that physicists call hadrons. Many types of hadrons are theoretically described, but most exist for only very brief amounts of time. Quarks have electric charge, color charge, mass, and spin, and having color charge means they exist solely inside of other kinds of particles and cannot exist alone, which is why quarks have never been studied on their own. Up, down, strange, charm, top, bottom. If you don't know what a quark is, it don't matter, you still got them. And with leptons and bosons, unless something's amiss, they make up everything. everything that we can see and that we know exists. Quarks can join together in two different ways, baryons and mesons, but most instantly decay. If a particle has three quarks, then it's a baryon. And if there's one quark and an antiquark, then it is a meson. These tiny bits of matter are part of almost everything, and there is no unified theory to make it less confusing. But the fact that we've identified that they exist at all is so goddamn remarkable that I just sit in awe. Oh, up, down, strange charm, top, bottom. If you don't know what a quark is, it don't matter, you still got them. And with leptons and bosons, unless something's amiss, they make up everything that we can see and that we know exists.
But the standard model is not as tidy as it could be if we wanted one theory to describe the entire universe. Remember, at the time of the Big Bang, the universe was very tiny, and relativity and quantum mechanics must have worked together, as the whole universe was so tiny. So general relativity must have coexisted with quantum mechanics or was created by it. This standard model has some glaring gaps. Some particles have charge, some don't. Some particles feel some forces, but not others. We have six types of quarks, three charged leptons, three neutral ones, four force-carrying particles, plus, when you include the mysterious world of dark matter and a so far undiscovered particle called graviton, the even less well-known dark energy, the situation is messy. Oh, and the standard model only works if we define some 19 free parameters such as the mass of particles. It is hard to imagine that the ultimate building blocks and most fundamental rules are found in this complexity. It seems there must be something simpler underlying all of this. A theory that brings all observable phenomena into the same mechanical framework. As we dive into the world of the super small, we encounter molecules, then atoms, then protons, neutrons, and electrons. Digging deeper, we find quarks and leptons. So could there be another layer? And how many additional layers? Even though they haven't been found, and certainly may not exist, we already have a name for the layer below quarks and leptons. These smaller particles are called prions. It was originally thought that the prion was the world's most abundant hybrid car, but that theory has now been largely debunked. So there could be a long line of undiscovered particles before we find the ultimate and smallest particle of all. But string theory... Oh, Ian, you finally remembered what the subject of this brainy lecture is. But string theory, thank you, is an alternative to the endless stream of smaller and smaller particles. It says that when we get to the smallest size of all, we don't find a particle, but rather an ultra-tiny vibrating string. So, how does that work? How can a string explain the variety of subatomic particles we know about? Essentially, scientists assign the various different vibrational patterns of the string to be the various known particles. You can get a sense of this by seeing what happens with a single string. If you pluck a note on a harpsichord, it resonates at one frequency. Play a different note, and you get into a different frequency. In string theory, all these notes are the different particles. Quantum strings are much more ambitious than boring electron orbits. The hope is that, tweaked just right, those discrete vibrational modes can be made to match the properties of every known particle. Particle mass just comes from the length of the string and its tension. Tension is, after all, just energy per unit length. So string length defines mass, but also defines which complex vibrational modes are possible, and those modes in turn define particle properties like electric charge and spin. So this is the great promise of superstring theory. By defining a single parameter, the string tension, all the possible particles should be automatically defined. Compare that one parameter to the 19 free parameters of the standard model. It sure sounds closer to a fundamental theory. Oh, did I mention that these are one-dimensional strings and that they are vibrating in 11 dimensions, not just our four? What was that? Yes, to embrace the simplicity of the string theory, we do need to introduce the mind-bending complexity of an additional 7 dimensions. The dimensions are super small. Oh, like that makes things better. So let me guess, they are so tiny that we can't even detect them? Yes. But on the other hand, out of the mathematics popped a closed string, the graviton. For free, you finally get a theory that unites gravity with all the other forces. For free! Well, for free, we just invented 7 new dimensions to pay for it. But if you lock 10 string theorists in a room, and I simply cannot recommend that course of action highly enough, and ask them what the strings are made of, they will blush and look at their feet. The answer that they will mumble into their beards may include pure mass energy, fundamental irreducible existence, topological irregularities in the fabric of reality, or most probably, it's a meaningless question. So, the beardy weirdies create 7 new dimensions as a nuclear terrarium, or nerarium, as no one calls it, for their magic jiggling strings, but if I ask them what this string is made of, they say, don't ask that, look at the tricks they can do. They can hold energy, they can stretch and merge to allow them to decay into different particles. Also, by having gravity as a loop, it is smeared around a two-dimensional area, avoiding the singularities and division by zero problems. A graviton otherwise would have to act on a point, creating other problems like mutual attraction and infinite gravity at the point. But strings have extent, so avoid all the point problems. So tiny vibrating strings seem to suggest that they can automatically reproduce general relativity and seem to promise to include all of quantum theory too. But on the other hand, a generation of theoretical physicists have worked on string theory and have not one testable theory for their efforts. So we have an interesting situation where string theory does not provide a unified model of how our universe works, but it is a framework that can be tweaked for something like 10 to the power 500 universes. And we have no real idea to determine which is ours. Everything in superstring theory just seems to be mind-bendingly hard. There is also a problem with the cosmological constant. This is a parameter that we think should be positive in physical theory, as the amount of energy that you have left when you take all the particles out of the universe. Being positive supports the accelerating, expanding universe. String theory doesn't really like that. It prefers either zero or negative cosmological constants. People are working very hard trying to get that positive cosmological constant. The other thing that string theory typically needs is supersymmetry. So if we found evidence of supersymmetry, that would be a good thing. But we haven't, and we're probably now not going to find it in the Large Hadron Collider. That is not to say that string theory is wrong, it just means that supersymmetry appears to be at a higher energy than the Large Hadron Collider can see. We sort of root for supersymmetry because we want the dark matter particle, the neutralino, and that comes from supersymmetry. Of course, it doubles the particles in our standard model, but on the plus side, the particles have excellent names such as squark, selectron, gluino, xeno, and wino. So, unless you are a complete psycho, you will have a load of questions for me, such as, how small exactly are these dimensions, and how small are these bits of string? Perhaps as small as the Planck length, 10 to the minus 35 of a meter. Can we even contemplate an experiment to directly detect their strings, or their dimensions, or any of this? I don't know. Seems unlikely. Has any of this got any experimental data? Nope. Do I believe in them? Don't be ridiculous. In that case, why are grown men and women, who really ought to know better, looking for these bits of string, and why don't they look for something easier, like fairies? Because this is a theory that came out of observations and mathematics and is consistent with special relativity and quantum field theory. It wasn't dreamed up and then the physicists manipulated the maths to fit. It certainly solves a huge number of problems with our standard model. But then again, it needs all those extra dimensions and supersymmetry. I guess we are attracted to superstring theory because all theories sound stupid right up to the moment that they don't.
End of brainy lecture.
And now, hat of the week, the bowler. The Earl of Leicester had a problem. The gamekeepers who patrolled his estate to deter poachers wore top hats, and these kept getting knocked off on branches and damaged. Could someone come up with a solution? Yes, indeed, someone could. The Earl's younger brother, Edward Cook, sought out the services of the hat makers Lock & Co. of St. James Street in central London. The commission was passed on to a certain William and Thomas Bowler, who designed a strong, low-domed, tight-fitting hat that covered with felt. Cook showed up at the Lock's place of business in December 1849 to inspect the creation. It is said that he put the bowler on the floor and stomped on it a couple of times. He pronounced the headgear suitable for gamekeepers and paid the company 12 shillings. That's about £50 in today's money. As was the habit of Lock & Co., they named the hat after the first customer to order it. The Cook was born. It only later took on the name of its actual designers. At first, the bowler hat was commonly used by working-class men in Britain. However, early in the 20th century, the hat became popular among London's gentlemen of finance and governance. Armies of bowler-hatted men marched into the City of London each morning to go about their toils in the counting houses, bureaucracies, and law chambers. The attire became the mark of the city gent. At the same time, it was lifted from the heads of working men who replaced it with the cloth cap. The type of hat became a statement about Britain's class system. But fashions change. The bowler hat came in for a bit of ridicule over its snobbishness, and its popularity faded, replaced by a more casual look. When the Cook bowler crossed the Atlantic to settle on the heads of Americans, it also required a new name. In the United States, it was called a derby or derby. However, the name also owes its provenance to a British aristocrat. Edward Stanley, the 12th Earl of Derby, set up a horse race in 1780. The horse race took his name and became known as a derby. When bowler hats arrived, stylish gentlemen wore them to watch the derby, and they took the name and attached it to bowlers. The derby became popular with cowboys and railroad workers. Author Lucius Beebe was moved to write that the authentic hat of the Old West was the cast iron derby, the bowler of Old Bond Street and the chapeau melon of French usage. He added that only a very small fraction of the population of the West, and that was largely in Texas and concerned with ranching, wore a Stetson or other variety of shade hat. Famous outlaws in the rough-and-tumble days of the 19th century wore derbies. The list includes Billy the Kid, Butch Cassidy, and Black Bart. Hollywood movies notwithstanding, officers of the law also wore derbies.
Feeling saucy, you need the shallot. A sauce, my kingdom for a sauce.
Cider Beurre Blanc. This sauce is superb with grilled scallops, braised turbot, or a simply poached sole on the bone. Your ingredients this week are 80 ml of cider vinegar, 60 grams of shallots finely chopped, 100 ml of sweet cider, that's the alcoholic cider, 50 grams of dessert apples, preferably a Cox, peeled and finely grated, 250 grams of butter chilled and diced, salt and freshly ground pepper. Put the cider vinegar and the shallots into a small, heavy base saucepan set over a low heat and reduce the liquid by half. Add the cider and grated apple and cook gently to reduce the liquid by about a third. Still over a low heat, incorporate the butter a little at a time using a whisk. The sauce must not boil, but merely tremble at about 90°C. I always use a thermometer, but if you have not got one, watch it like a hawk. If you are a member of the uncontacted arrow people of the Amazonian basin, then you could watch it like a harpy eagle, grey-bellied goshawk, white-throated hawk, puna hawk, zone-tailed hawk. Look, arrow people, you have a ton of hawks to choose from. Just don't serve this cider Beurre Blanc with a hawk. It is unseemly. Season with salt and pepper to taste and serve immediately or keep warm over a bain-marie.
Feeling saucy, you need the shallots.
And now, songs under the microscope. In Charles Dickens's Barnaby Rudge, there was included the lyrics to the nursery rhyme, Polly Put the Kettle On. Barnaby Rudge was published in 1841, so we can assume that the rhyme had been around a bit before that. The story tells the tale of the eponymous Polly putting on a kettle in order for all the proponents to have tea. Then Sukey takes it off again as they all went away. 200 years ago, someone put a kettle on, changed their mind, and we are still singing about it. How did that go viral? Where was the character development? Where was man's struggle against the universe? Where was the narrative arc? Oh, and by the way, Sukey and Polly were still there. Why couldn't they be allowed to have tea? 200 years! Einstein gave us an enduring theory of gravity in his general relativity, and he gets no songs. A plan for the entire movement of the universe, the curving of space-time, and no songs. Well, obviously accepting Einstein a go-go by landscape. But other than that... Oh, and Jimmy Buffett's 2013 hit, Einstein Was a Surfer. Oh, and Einstein on the Beach by Counting Crows. Okay, let's have an Einstein top 10. In at number 10, Einstein a Go-Go by Landscape. New entry at number 9 is Stupid Einstein by The 3 O'Clock. Second week at number 8 for Einstein's Day by Mission of Burma. Number 7 is Jeremy Tuplin and the Albert Einstein Song. Number 6, a non-mover, Einstein Was a Surfer by Jimmy Buffett. Straight in at number 5 is Einstein on the Beach by equally mathematical Counting Crows. Number 4, second week in the charts for Kelly Clarkson and Einstein. Number 3 is last week's number 1, Einstein's Taking Off by the Ugly Duckling. Number 2, a non-mover, Einstein's Brain by Admiral Freebie. And number 1 for the 11th week running is Randy Newman's 1977 hit, Sigmund Freud's Impersonation of Albert Einstein in America. And if I remember, I will provide a link on OneTube for you. Interesting, the anagram of Polly Put the Kettle On is Leak Lepton Hotly Put, Pellet Ethyl Punk Toot. Help Naughty Pellet Out, Larval Lethal Wee. Kayaking a Toffee Suit, Infatuate a Key Fog Ski, A Kinky Outfit Saga Fee, Healthy Genome Love. So whilst... you're welcome. So whilst the character development is limited... Tell me that's not an improvement. So whilst the character development is limited, at least the body count is low. By children's nursery rhyme standards. In Ring a Ring a Roses, they all die. In Oranges and Lemons, we have death by decapitation. Pop Goes the Weasel is an early version of Les Miserables, where here the protagonist must sell his clothes just to buy some food to survive the day. And what psycho would sing Three Blind Mice to their children, if we consider the following harrowing lines? Three blind mice... Three blind mice, see how they run, see how they run. They all ran after the farmer's wife, who cut off their tails with a carving knife. Did you ever see such a thing in your life as three blind mice? Firstly, the mice were blind. They were not chasing the farmer's wife. They were running blindly, and she happened to be in their way. I must say, though, Mrs. Farmer did well with her carving knife to cut off all their tails. In London Bridge is Falling Down, do remember that in the original London Bridge there were houses on the bridge with real people living in them. Perhaps a mandatory eviction notice rather than a ditty suggesting possible remedial measures, built it up with wood and clay. It sounds like exactly the sort of building methods that got them into this mess in the first place. And whilst we're at it, Humpty Dumpty, his crime, sitting on a wall. Punishment, death. Next, we have religious intolerance in Goosey Goosey Gander. Its second verse has, There I met an old man who wouldn't say his prayers. I took him by the left leg and threw him down the stairs. Another head trauma and probable death here It's raining, it's pouring, the old man is snoring. He went to bed and bumped his head and couldn't get up in the morning. And now it's time for our advert. Want a selfie with the Eiffel Tower, but you are afraid it will expose your grandiose narcissism? Use our new Narcissism Minus selfie camera that uses powerful artificial intelligence image manipulation algorithms to digitally remove you from the photo and reinstate the objects behind you. Are you concerned that posting selfies tells the world that you are unlikable and insecure? Fear not. Our Narcissism Minus camera will disguise your fears and replace you with the Taj Mahal. It was hiding behind you all the time. Throw people off the scent about your low self-worth by taking a selfie of someone else. The Narcissism Minus has an additional rear-facing lens that can capture someone else pretending to hold up the Golden Gate Bridge. If you have ever wondered what the Himalayas, Colosseum, Pyramids, Big Ben, or the Great Wall of China look like, then take your pictures with Narcissism Minus. See the wonders of the world, not wondering what's behind you. And now, literally, the last section. How do words enter the English language? The most obvious way is through refugee words arriving on our shores. Britain is the Ellis Island of language. We really are not fussy. We accepted pyjama and shampoo from India, chaparral from the Basques, caucus from the Algonquin Indians, ketchup from China, potato from Haiti, sofa from Arabia, boondocks from the Tagalog language of the Philippines, slogan from Gaelic. Words can reach us through different routes and different times and be assigned different meanings. So we got canal and channel, regard and reward, poor and pauper, catch and chase, cave and cage, amiable and amicable. Sometimes we get the triple bonus plays such as cattle, chattel and capital, hotel, hostel and hospital, and straight, straight and strict. There is at least one sextuplet, jaunty, gentle, genteel, gentry, genital and genteel. Of course, we have Shakespeare, who gave us at least 1,700 words. He gave us academy, accused, addiction, advertising, amazement, arouse, assassination, bandit, bedroom, blanket, bloodstained, barefaced, blushing, bet, bump, buzzer, compromise, courtship, countless, dwindle, elbow, excitement, exposure, presumably so he could regulate the amount of light entering his camera, eyeball, fashionable, fixture, brutal, generous, gloomy, gossip, gust, hint, hobnob, though I suspect in the sense of meeting and he had nothing to do with the invention of the oat-based confection, jaded, label, lackluster, monumental, mountaineer, negotiate, obscene, outbreak, pandas, pedant, premeditated, puking, skim milk, tranquil, undress, unreal, zany, gnarled, and grovel. Bafflingly, sometimes words evolve to invert their meaning. So counterfeit used to mean a legitimate copy, brave once meant cowardice, garble meant to sort out, and manufacture used to mean something made by hand. Next, we borrow a foreign word, then spawn several new words. For example, the French word mutin, rebellion, in turn turns into mutiny, mutinous, mutinously, mutineer, mutiny on the bounty, while the French still have just the one form, mutin. But there are words that have made an appearance in English, oft through a circuitous route, but for no reason they fall out of fashion. Luckily, we are here to catch them and reintroduce them. One such word is velleity. Whilst we still have volition, we have lost velleity. It represents the fantastic notion of a slight desire to do something, but not enough to actually do it. I had the velleity to create some examples for you, but in the end it seemed too much of a faff. But of all the way words get hatched, my favourite are the words created by mistake. The most famous of these, perhaps, is the dord, which appeared in the 1934 Merriam-Webster International Dictionary as another word for density. In fact, someone had scribbled down that its symbol could be written as capital D or little d, meaning that density could be abbreviated by either the capital or lowercase letter. The people at Merriam-Webster quickly removed it, but not before it had found its way into other dictionaries. Such occurrences are more common than you might suppose. According to the first supplement of the OED, there are at least 350 words in the English dictionaries that owe their existence to errors. For the most part, they are fairly obscure. One such meaning is messuage, a legal term used to describe a house, its land and buildings. It is thought to be simply a careless transcription of the French ménage. Many other words owe their existence to mishearings. Buttonhole was once buttonholed. Sweetheart was originally sweetard, as in dullard and dotard. And now Eric Carle's The Very Hungry Caterpillar. This classic illustrated story begins when a cute little caterpillar hatches and thinks to himself, "I have arrived. I am born. I have a mouth, stomach, hunger. I need to eat something." And that's exactly what he does, eating huge portions of clearly human food. But he is also highly wasteful. The first thing he does is eat just a hole through an apple. Now that apple is ruined and he is still hungry. He does not go back and eat the rest of the apple. No, he goes off and destroys two pears. And so he goes on. In fact, in my copy of the book, the louche larval Lepidoptera ate all the way through the pages and the cover. In the book on Saturday, he ate through one piece of chocolate cake, one ice cream cone, one pittle, one slice of Swiss cheese, one slice of salami, one lollipop, one piece of cherry pie, a sausage, a cupcake, and a slice of watermelon. Oh, and then he moaned that he had a stomachache. So he eats a bit of leaf. So after stuffing his pie hole for a week, now he decides to have a salad? As he binge eats, he grotesquely inflates into what is no longer a cute caterpillar and is a miserable-looking cake of lard. So he lies down, tucks himself into his cocoon, succumbs to the sweet nothingness, and wakes up fabulous. What kind of grotesque message is this book conveying? Shoveling a refrigerator full of food into your face hole until you feel like somebody loves you is not a healthy message to be giving. And I just checked the recommended age on Amazon, 3 to 5 year olds. Binge eating will make you more miserable, not less. He is not fat and happy. He is full of self-loathing as he steals himself for yet another serving. Hey, lava boy, it's food, not love. So the takeaway message for our 3 to 5 year olds is, binge eating is great, and the worst consequence will be waking up the next day even prettier than before. But the caterpillar was not the eventual winner of this week's overeating competition. The old woman who swallowed a fly takes the cake. Well, in fact, the cake was just about the only thing that she did not take. She ate a fly, spider, bird, cat, dog, then cow, and finally a horse. At least in this cautionary tale, the old woman had the common decency of dying. She did not wake up young and gorgeous. And that is the end of literally the last section. It is also the end of this week's podcast. In next week's Frenzied and Sustained, our brainy lecture finally turns its attention to dark energy and asks if we are heading towards a big rip. In literally the last section, we delve into the morally murky world of Thomas the Tank Engine, assuming that my 28 volumes have been delivered in time for me to get down and snarky with them. Our song under the microscope is the middle-of-the-road pap song Ebony and Ivory, and we use music theory to show why Paul McCartney made a very poor choice of metaphor for racism. keeping our heads warm next week in the Hat of the Week will be the Ushanka. Please point your browser at
Frenzied and Sustained.
Sustained.com and click on the link to say hello. We are doubling our audience every week, and I would love to know what's on your mind. And remember, there are only two types of people in the world. Those that can extrapolate from incomplete data,